So welcome to the second class of our 5-week introductory course in mindfulness practice. And for those of you who might be new, these 5 weeks are devoted to teaching you some of the basics of mindfulness practice, both as a meditation practice and as a practice that you can bring into your daily life, how to bring more attention, how to use attention as an aid, as a support for a wiser, more awakened life. Before I start with what I'm going to talk about this evening, what I like to do at the beginning of each day of each class is to give you a chance to ask any questions you might have. The idea is that as you do the class, you're practicing at home every day, and from that you might have some questions from the week before, from your own experience. So does anyone have any questions or anything they want to report or say before we start? Yes?
Do you have a simple definition of the word mindfulness?
A simple definition of mindfulness is as simple as paying attention. It's attentiveness. The mindfulness is mindfulness is a little bit different than just, it's the ability to give attention in the field of our awareness. So we can be aware of things. We'll be aware of many of things going on in this room. Some of the stuff that you're being aware of in this room, you might not be giving your attention to. Supposedly, you're giving your attention to me speaking because I'm the speaker. And you might be doing that, but you might be aware of other people in the room and other things going on. But you're giving your attention here. And mindfulness is the capacity to give our attention to something, to see it clearly for what it is. So in mindfulness practice, what we're learning to do is to rest in the field of awareness, have enough trust of life so that we can rest in the awareness, and then in that awareness to then give our attention to what we're going to pay attention to. So for some people, a lot of what they're learning as they do this practice is learning to trust. Many people are very mistrustful, very fearful, or hanging on to things or resisting things, and with their awareness, with their very presence. And in order for this practice to unfold, it unfolds better, more easily, if there is a sense of trust in just being present, just being sitting here, being alive. If we sit here being unguarded, undefended. Other questions? Yes?
As a neophyte, I found that the monkey mind was calmed quite a bit by focusing on breath. But after a while, it can do, the monkey mind's clever, it can do both. And I found that another thing, I'm not sure it was any good, but interested in your reaction, was to cause a physical sensation of some kind that I could focus on. It wasn't abstract, wasn't mental, wasn't even automatic like the breath. I was simply, in my case, just pressing a thumb against the finger and focusing on that. It seemed to draw attention to something mindful or very mindful.
Uh-huh. Yeah, this is what we're going to be talking about today. Is how to include our bodily physical sensations within the field of mindfulness. So hopefully the whole class today will address maybe what you're interested in here. And if it doesn't, then maybe the end of the day, end of the evening, you can ask again. But yeah, the mind is very tricky, and the monkey mind, the mind that wants to be distracted, often will resist in all kinds of clever ways our desire to be attentive, to be present in the present. And we have to contend with the tricks of the mind. Yes?
Well, being a very visual person, I had a similar experience to that, in that, you know, there's this kind of constant moving besides the sound, you know. And one thing I did was just very, very slowly open my eyes when I was kind of looking at the rug, in a kind of blurry, half-looking way. And at least the kind of turn the movie off or down, because you can see things while you're looking at something else, but lessen the distance. Not having darkness can lessen that.
Uh-huh. Great. Yeah, that's quite good. Different people, some people are more thinkers. Their thinking mind takes the form of more words, and some people it takes more the form of visualizations or images. And sometimes for people who get easily caught up in images, it can, as you just said, it can be quite helpful to open the eyes a little bit so the imaging doesn't happen quite as easily. Yes? If a person is, there's no particular book that I recommend, but a very nice beginning book that doesn't give the instructions for mindfulness, but gives kind of the understanding for the practice of mindfulness, is a book by Stephen Levine's first book called A Gradual Awakening. They're very short little chapters, each of them kind of containing some of the understanding that goes with this practice, and it can be very supportive of this practice. Yes?
I have very vivid visualization, but it's just a pattern, and I look forward to it, and I've been looking for it and looking into it. If I would say encouraging it in a way, would I be better off trying not to do that?
For the purposes of mindfulness meditation, you're much better off not encouraging any particular experience. And in addition to that, not giving any special interest or value to any particular experience, because that tends to perpetuate our involvement, perpetuate the entanglement we have with it. And what we're trying to do is to discover an unentangled mind, unentangled heart. So when visualizations arise on their own, then, as we'll talk about today, the practice of mindfulness is to just see clearly this is what's going on in the present moment, as opposed to knowing what's going on and then getting involved in it. There's a kind of independent ability to be aware of what's happening that we take refuge in. Oh, this is what's happening right now. So as I talk today, maybe that becomes clear. So I like to distinguish. It's very important for the purposes of mindfulness to distinguish between our direct experience that we have and the concepts, the ideas which we have of that experience. And most of us tend to live in the world of our interpretations, concepts, ideas, judgments about experience. Much of our thinking sometimes is about things, as opposed to being, we live in a world of aboutness, as opposed to living in direct contact with our experience and with life. And maybe this is illustrated with this example I like to give. Of some years ago, a number of years ago now, I was watching football on television with two other meditation teachers. And one of them had the mute button, and as far as I know, all sensible people, when the commercials come on, they push the mute button. And so he did that, and we started talking about something for a while, and it was very nice. And then at some point, the football game started again, and we stopped our conversation and started watching the football game. However, my friend who had the remote in his hand, he did not push the mute button again to bring on the sound. And so we were watching a silent football game. And I thought, this is a teacher of mindfulness, of paying attention. I'm certain he must know that the sound's not on. this seems somewhat unusual that he would choose just to watch without the sound on. And so rather than nudging him, I'm just going to sit here and find out what this is about. So I watched for a while the football game without the sound. And it was quite easy for me to follow what was going on with the game, right? I mean, all these guys, they line up, they fall down, and they line up again, they fall down. And then every once in a while, some guy kind of, you know, breaks through and catches the ball, and you can see him going down the field. It's very nice. You see some other guy that's kind of chasing him, and the other guy catches him, and he falls down on the, you can see, oh, it's kind of near the goal line. That's, you know, he almost made it, but he didn't quite. So it's all kind of, you know, matter of fact. But when the difference, well, then at some point he turned the sound back on again. And the difference was that with the sound, we had the commentator, the sportscaster, who was making commentary about the game as we went along. And I suspect that part of the job description of the sportscaster is to excite the television audience, to get you into the game. And in fact, that's what it did. You know, it isn't just simply, oh, these guys are standing up and falling down, and here he's going down the field, looks like he's going to make it, that's very nice. Like, oh, you get up and you stand, and you, oh, he's going to do it, yes, yes, oh my God, he got tackled. You know, and because somehow it's contagious, you know, the excitement of the commentator. But the experience of watching, well, what most of us don't distinguish is the difference between the football game in and of itself and the football game as we experience it through the voice of the commentator, the sportscaster. And those two things are entangled in us, and so our experience of watching football on television is they're completely entangled. For those of you who don't watch television, maybe it's canned comedy on television where they have canned laughter. And so it actually increases your sense of delight for many people to have that, you know, it's contagious, right? To have that laughing, that canned laughter kind of to tell you when you're supposed to feel funny. And so the experience is not just simply the joke. The experience is a joke through the filter of the laughter that you hear in the background. So our experience of life is often it's mediated through commentary. And this happens also in our own minds. Our minds have, as sportscasters, newscasters, gossip columns, you know, it has it all. These people, you know, it's doing it constantly, making commentary. Oh, I like that. That wasn't so nice. Why didn't he say it a little bit differently? Or I wish I had said that, or, you know, or whatever. People go on and on, you know, with our commentary of what's going on. And our commentary is not the same thing as the actual experience. It's a commentary about it. It's flavored by interpretations and judgments. Now, it's a normal thing to do, to live in the, to have commentary, but many of us live in the commentary, and our whole experience of world is through the filter of commentary, through our ideas and judgments of stuff, rather than seeing things as they actually are. Some of us have that experience if people see us through some old category which is no longer valid. Once upon a time, you're never angry, but once upon a time you were angry. But the last person, the only time that person met you was that one time. So now every time this person sees you again after that time, they assume you're an angry person. They're seeing you through the filter of that commentary, that idea. And it feels oppressive. Someone who only seen as being, you know, a spouse of someone else. You know, it feels a little bit oppressive to be in that category only. And we do this to ourselves. It's much harder to see how we do it to ourselves. We put ourselves in our commentaries or interpretations. We see ourselves through a filter of ideas or interpretations or judgments. And so then that, you know, we don't experience ourselves directly, but we have these often ancient ideas that we've gotten from our childhood or from any part in our life that I'm not competent, or, I'm super competent, or we have all these ideas we have, and we carry those with us. Rather than let ourselves be who we are in the moment, we see ourselves through some idea. It can be seen very clearly sometimes in meditation practice, especially if someone's a beginner. Sooner or later someone will have the idea, you know, I can't do this. I'm not a very competent person. You know, this is too difficult for me. That's an interpretation. You know, you probably don't have enough evidence to know that. But we very quickly kind of will put on the commentary and see it through that. Or we have the opposite commentary. We really inflate ourselves You know, I've never done meditation before, but it doesn't seem very, very difficult. And who are all these people around me who are having difficulty with it? You know, I'm on the verge of Buddhahood. And, you know, and that's another form of commentary. So the idea in meditation is to shift the attention, shift our presence out of the commentary into something larger, some larger sense of self. It isn't that you have to stop the commentary, but you need to see the commentary as commentary, maybe not necessarily believe it, and then shift, and can you be more present for things as they actually are? Can you be with your breath as it actually is, as opposed to the idea about your breath? Someone can have a shallow, difficult breathing, and you can just be aware of that in and of itself, or you can have this idea, oh, it shouldn't be this way. The breath shouldn't be shallow and deep, shallow and tight. Shallow and tight means that I'm uptight. I'm uptight because of the kind of work I chose, and I chose the kind of work I chose because the kind of childhood I had, and therefore I have the wrong parents. And so the commentary gets quite elaborate, you know, very quickly. And it, the original experience was very simple, just your breath was tight and shallow. Why don't you just leave it there? Leave it that way. And why do you have to get into your parents, you know? Just here, I'm a human being with a shallow and tight breathing. So what we try to do in mindfulness practice, and what's very restful in the long term, is to learn how to rest in that direct experience, rather than taking up residence in all the commentary where most of us live. So with that as a general introduction, let's do our first sitting this evening. So we begin by taking an alert but comfortable posture, having your spine be a little bit more alert than maybe you normally would have it, and then gently close your eyes. And then in the beginning of a period of meditation, it's often nice to take a few deep breaths. And as you breathe in deeply, to let that inhalation connect you with the inside of your body, with your body. And then as you breathe out a little bit more fully than normal, to let the exhalation relax you. Let go with the exhalation. Breathing in deeply. Letting go into your seat, into your cushion. And then letting your breathing return to normal. And there's no right or wrong way of breathing. Just the way you're breathing is fine. Just let breath breathe itself. It can also be helpful in the beginning of a sitting to relax some of the muscles in your body that might be tense. And I find it useful to begin with the forehead. Soften the forehead. As you breathe out, relaxing the jaws, the face. As you breathe out, relaxing the shoulders. letting the chest be soft. And to whatever capacity you have, to let the belly be relaxed and soft, letting the belly hang forward, so that an expanded belly supports your diaphragm, supports the rest of your torso. And let your awareness be relaxed. Take a few moments not to be aware of anything in particular, but just to let awareness kind of float and let whatever occurs appear in your awareness. There's no right or wrong thing to be aware of. Just be aware of whatever appears that's happening in the present moment. What in your present experience comes to awareness? And then within that awareness, gently give your attention to your breathing. Or give your breathing to your attention. So you become aware of what it feels like to be having a breathing body. How does your body experience your breathing? Notice whatever tendency you have to get involved in your thoughts, get lost in them, or to get involved in commentary, and simply shift, relax your attention into your breathing again. Begin again, feeling and sensing your breathing. In the way that gently rocking a baby soothes the baby, so let the alternating rhythm of breathing in and breathing out calm or relax your mind, your heart. Let it cool the fires of the mind. when the mind wanders off in thoughts. There's no need to have any commentary about that. Just simply begin again, being mindful of your breathing. It can be quite a relief to know that you don't need to have any commentary. You can just be with the way things are. Notice if you're caught up in your thoughts. The very act of noticing that is to be mindful. The very act of noticing that you're involved or lost in your commentary is to begin to be free of it. Appreciate that moment of freedom, of disentanglement. And then very simply come back to your breathing. The breathing helps us to be very simple. Let yourself be as simple as your breathing. And then as we come near the last period of this sitting, let go of the breath in terms of what you pay attention to. And bring your attention to whatever physical sensation in your body is most pronounced. It doesn't have to be very strong, but whatever happens to be the most pronounced physical experience in your body. And without moving or doing anything about the experience, very simply give your attention to that sensation, allowing the sensation to be there. Seeing if you can separate your attention from your commentary about the sensation. Separate your attention from your ideas about what the sensation is. And let yourself be really simply present for that sensation in your body. If in an easy way it makes sense, let yourself become more intimate with the sensation, feel it more carefully, but allowing it to be there. And notice what happens to the sensation as you're present for it. Does it get stronger or weaker? Does it go away? If it goes away, then find a different sensation. But discover what it's like to bring a very simple awareness. To a physical sensation. As if awareness creates lots of room around this physical sensation, letting the sensation exist in the great, big, spacious room of awareness. Being aware of the sensation. And then you can let go of physical sensations, and just come back again very simply for another minute with your breathing, last minute of sitting. Regardless of what is happening to you, see if you can be fully and completely and relaxedly present for your breathing. So the word mindfulness that we use in English as a translation of the Buddhist word sati perhaps gives the wrong impression because it has the word mind in it. And I think we often assume that our awareness resides in our mind. And it's a kind of a mental thing, the paying attention that we do. There's certainly a mental side of it, but I think we might just as well translate mindfulness as bodyfulness. It's because a very, very important foundational part of mindfulness practice is embodiment, is to be in our body, is to let the body be the vehicle or the antenna, the receptor for our experience of life. To begin, mindfulness training is a training to help us start living our life through our body and with our body, so that the body and mind are partners in all this, as opposed to the mind thinking that it's an independent operator, ready to go off and do whatever it wants to do. Someone just a little while ago told me that she teaches mindfulness-based stress reduction at Kaiser. And she wants to teach mindfulness practices to people in corporations. And she says it's really unfortunate that people don't really start taking real serious interest in their health or their state of their mind or start learning something like mindfulness until they're really suffering. And really be better if they did it beforehand. We have these minds which don't want to kind of admit that we're often that we're limited. And we're kind of racing often ahead of ourselves. And we live not only in the commentary about our lives, commentary of what happened in the past, our prophecies about the future, but we also live in our drivenness. The drivenness of our mind. We're driven in all kinds of different ways. We're driven to do a lot of things. It's a wonderful modern word, multitasking. I suspect that if you 100 years ago you asked someone to define multitasking, and they would look at you and thought you were crazy. What's that mean? And what happens with multitasking, in a sense, is the mind is going in different directions at the same time. And all this momentum is going. And it's the momentum of the mind which gets interested in multitasking, the demands, the needs, the fears, the ambitions, the drivenness. And so we get caught up then in the world of our mind, the mental world. And that world then drives what we do. And the body is just this slave that just has to kind of take commands and follow along the best it can, you know, and do all the instructions. And if you are a really sound constitution, maybe the body will hold up and do a lot. But if you don't have a strong constitution, sometimes the limitations that the body puts on the mind occur much earlier than for other people. We tend to live in mind time, the time which our mind sets. And the mind can live in very fast time because the mind can want things at a phenomenal pace. You know, how many desires a minute is it possible to have? I think it's possible to have a lot. And so the mind gets in this very fast, hectic mode, getting things done, getting, you know. Or maybe it's not very fast, it's just frightened. You know, so the fear is such a preoccupation. We get so concerned in the fear that we enter into this mental world of the fear and not aware of what's happening with our body, not aware of what's happening in the present moment in the particular situation we're in. Not recognizing, perhaps, that in this particular moment, this particular time and place, there's absolutely nothing to be afraid of. The fear has nothing to do with here and now, but has to do with some possibility outside of here and now. And if that's the case, isn't the here and now a place that can be relaxed into more, that we can be more trusting about? You'll find that you're able to relax and trust the present moment much more. You find that you'll be able to be much more relaxed if you make the choice that, in fact, the present moment is much more trustable than you're granting it. So we tend to live, for some various reasons, in our minds, in our thoughts, in our commentary, our ideas. We often are then ahead of our bodies. And one of the ways this takes is that we often are looking after relief. The mind mostly wants relief. The body, I think, in its deepest whatever, doesn't really want relief. It wants release. And there's a big difference between release and relief. So, for example, if you feel really tight in your shoulders. And you can see this often, meditators, they sit down, they're kind of tight, or some middle of the sitting, they feel kind of tight in their shoulders, and they start stretching their necks, and doing all kinds of nice stretches. And there's a certain impulse for relief, for avoidance, for improving things. And we think that the way to provide that relief, or that release, is by stretching, or... And to some degree, we can get some relief, but we don't get release necessarily from stretching. Part of the reason is that the tensions in our shoulders arise because of tensions in our mind. And if we're only addressing the physical part as a mechanical thing that we can stretch and pull, then the root cause is to lash out at something. And there's a kind of a feeling we want to just kind of follow through on an impulse. America is about, in a kind of stereotypic way at least, is about the freedom to do whatever we want. Buddhist practice is not the freedom to do whatever you want, which is maybe disappointing to some of you. But Buddhist practice teaches us to be free from our impulses. So the impulse to want something arises. And there's a certain kind of relief that can come from giving in to that and following through on it. You know, if you're really angry with someone and you want to punch them out, if you do that, there's a kind of relief that comes, you know. It's kind of feel a little better for a moment. But that doesn't really get down to the root that allows a deeper release that needs to happen. And in fact, some activities, if you keep acting them out, reinforces it as a habit. So, what we do in mindfulness practice is we bring, rather than looking for relief, we bring our attention, we give our attention very carefully to those impulses and feelings and sensations. And to feel it very carefully, and in the feeling and being present for it, discover how to be released in the middle of it, not to be caught by it. To discover how to be independent of the impulses, and by giving lots of space in terms of lots of awareness, to let that impulse or let that feeling sensation unravel itself. The unraveling of itself is much more powerful than is our acting on wanting relief. Often when we want relief, it's mostly the mind kind of negotiating and figuring out and manipulating and fixing how things should be. But if we can drop down into the body and feel how it is, how things are actually felt in the body, the body itself, the conscious body, the body that's felt consciously, will more often than not release itself in its own time. In a way that you can't really engineer from the mind's point of view. I don't know if all this makes sense, but to kind of get around this from another angle. Fundamental to mindfulness practice is being embodied in our body, to be present for us in our body and experience our world through our body, to live in body time rather than in mind time, to feel that, to discover that it's useful to let the body take the lead in the pace in which we live our life, as opposed to letting all our mind kind of racing ahead of itself. To feel our body, to let the body then become a sensitive instrument that connects us to the world around us and that connects us to ourselves. If we live in the mind all the time, in the commentary and thoughts, we tend to be quite removed from all the information the body is ready to give us about how we're feeling, how we're reacting and responding to the world. It's all there in our body, ready to be read, ready to be felt, ready to be experienced. The body is, I find, is phenomenally wise. The body has a phenomenal amount of information, of wisdom, to tell us about how to live our lives. That is not accessible to us if we're always caught up in the mind, in the thoughts and commentary and ideas that we have. So very central to mindfulness practice is learning to pay attention to our body. And perhaps you can say it more deeply, learning to live within our body. Or to say it even more intimately, to let ourselves be inseparable from our body. So it isn't that, you know, famous question, are you your body or are you in your body? Are you in your body or are you your body? And then many people kind of at least operate in the notion that, you know, my body is just this stuff that kind of I have to carry around with me. And I'm kind of in it directing the show. I'm the, you know, the stage director. But there's a tremendous intimacy between our mental and physical life, so much so that you can't actually make that distinction. I think it's much, in some sense, more accurate to say we are our body. More accurate than to say that we are in our body. And those of you who know Buddhist doctrine know that there's more to it than that. But so then part of mindfulness practice, a very important part of it, is beginning to train ourselves, to sensitize ourselves to our embodied life, to our felt life, the felt experience of living as opposed to the thoughts about living. What's the felt sense that you have right now of being alive? What's the felt sense you have right now of sitting here in this room? how easy is it for you to make commentary about that felt sense? How easy is it for you just to rest in the felt sense as you sit here right now? So in mindfulness, we train ourselves to begin paying attention to our physical body. Now, in the simple instructions of mindfulness meditation, it's explained this way. We first sit down to meditate, and we give our attention, we relax, and we give our attention to our breathing. We feel the breathing arising and passing. And we've kind of, in a sense, we place our breathing in the foreground of our attention. In the background of our attention, there may be many things that you're aware of. Sounds, thoughts, feelings, sensations, itches, emotions. As long as those things are in the background, you can just leave them there. As long as you can stay with the breath is in the foreground, you can stay there with the rising and passing of each breath. Just stay there, hang out there. Get to know your breathing better. When some physical sensation in your body comes into the foreground, then the instruction is to let go of your breathing and give your attention to this physical sensation. So some people try to hold on to the breathing as if the breath is what you're supposed to pay attention with no matter what. And sometimes there can arise a tension then between the sensation in your body that really wants attention and your idea you're supposed to be staying with the breath. There's no need for that tension in this meditation practice. Rather, what we do is relax, let go of the breathing, and give our attention to this sensation in the body, the physical sensation. And it could be, the whole gamut of sensations that might appear predominantly. If it's a strong, if you're new to meditation, it might be an uncomfortable sensation. It's quite common for new meditators to feel, especially if you're sitting on the floor, so sooner or later feel some discomfort in your legs or your back, your knees perhaps or something. And then it's a very common commentary to have, oh, if only my knees didn't hurt, then I could really meditate. They're standing in my way of meditating. I'd be a great meditator if this back was just a little bit better. But there's no need for that kind of idea in meditation, that there's some other, some experiences in the way of developing mindfulness. Rather, what we do is we take those sensations of the knee or the back or whatever, and we give our attention to it. We feel it. It becomes the meditative subject. It becomes what the meditative mind becomes aware of. We receive it in the meditative mind, those sensations in the body. And this is very different than how many people relate, especially to discomfort. Many of us, when we feel uncomfortable, want to fix it. We want to manipulate it. We grab for the aspirins. We want to stretch our legs. We want to, do anything we can to try to avoid having discomfort. And there's a lot of support in our culture for that strategy. I knew one mindfulness teacher who, one of his students got really angry with him when he taught kind of an introductory course like this, because he was saying, when you feel some discomfort in your body, some pain, bring your attention to it. He'd spent his whole life trying to avoid being with it, and he was being told, now he's been told, bring your attention to it. That seemed like the very opposite of the relief that he wanted from his pain. But in mindfulness, we bring our attention to whatever is the strongest sensation. And if a strong physical sensation predominates over our staying with the breath, then that becomes the meditation, that strong sensation. Sometimes it can be a very strong, pleasant sensation that arises in meditation. A lot of warm tingling or vibration or pulsing some places in the body. And in that case, we matter-of-factly bring our attention to that and feel that. And the idea is to feel it in a non-reactive way, without commentary or, at least not without getting caught up in the commentary, and just feeling it, what it is in and of itself as a direct experience. Getting to know it better, exploring it. What's very fascinating is that because many of us live in the world of concepts, we actually keep ourselves removed from our direct experience. We don't really know what things are like. And this can be seen very clearly with physical pain. We keep ourselves quite a distance from physical pain, and we have all these ideas of what it is. But if you bring a very careful, attentive mindfulness to the pain itself, it very quickly appears very different than what you thought it was. For example, rather than being some solid mass of pain, you might see it's made up of a variety of different sensations which are sparking or pulsing or rising and passing. And it isn't a solid, substantial pain, but it's actually a constantly fluttering and moving sensation around the knee. The rising and passing is dancing. And if it's dancing and not staying in one place even, maybe it's a lot easier to stay with it. When we see it as a solid mass of pain, it can be very difficult to stay with it. As we investigate the physical pain, we might see the ways in which our mental reactions to it cause us to suffer. We feel physical pain and we suffer because we resist it, we tighten around it. I mean, one great way to suffer more is you feel some physical pain and then you have so much aversion to it, the muscles around that tighten up even more, and then you feel even more pain. We have judgments about it, or about ourselves for having it. You know, oh, how could I have been so stupid to come to a meditation class? I mean, I could be out dancing this evening, you know, or there's all these more better things to be doing than sitting here with leg pain. I mean, what in the world was I thinking? So we have this all suffering about, you know, blaming ourselves for our choices. So the idea of mindfulness is to, in the most compassionate way you can imagine, just see that tendency of how we react, the judgments we make about it, and see that those things are different from the actual pain. And then train ourselves just to be with the direct pain itself and see what happens. The same thing with strong, pleasant sensations when they arise. To just bring our attention and matter-of-factly just see it, be with it, give our attention to it, and not to make a story out of it. You know, oh, you know, this is the best, you know, and I think I'm going to sign up for that 90-day meditation retreat because, you know, I really deserve 90 days of this kind of bliss. And so the mind wanders off, you know, holding on to that. And then the next day you sit down to meditate, that physical delight is not there. And then you spend the next 45 minutes in meditation kind of looking for it and just, where is it? And upset because it's not there. The mind does all this stuff. The training in meditation is to become really simple. Just let it be what it is. Pleasant, unpleasant, just let it be. Discover that freedom of mind that can just let things be as they are without getting all wrapped up and entangled in them, that they have to be different. So sensation arises in the body and it's more pronounced than the breathing. We let go of the breath and we bring our attention to that part of the body and we feel it. It can be very helpful in that process to, in a very subtle, quiet way, name or label that physical sensation. Because as I said last week, to very simply name it like pain or hardness or tightening or tension or warmth or coolness, to have a very, very simple, obvious name to it. It's using that part of the mind which thinks to help you stay focused on what you're paying attention to, as opposed to letting the thinking mind be idle so it can think about whatever it wants. And then it'll think about Tahiti, you know, or pizza or something. One of the most amazing things to me is, you know, you can have this tremendous spiritual inspiration and intention to kind of, this is like the most important spiritual practice you know, and your full spirituality is kind of being channeled into sitting down here, and you're going to sit here and really be present for yourself and give yourself lots of compassionate and accepting presence and sit here and can be fully liberated, you know, because you're just on fire, your spiritual fire, and you sit down with all this intention, and then in 30 seconds you're thinking about pizza. It's kind of amazing, isn't it? Or some equivalent of that. So to begin training ourselves to be present for what's actually happening for us, with what's actually happening, being present for the physical sensations, that's what's predominant. And physical sensation also means all the sense doors, hearing, smelling, tasting, I suppose. So, for example, if you're sitting and meditating and there's a strong sound, dog barks outside or neighbor yells or whatever, many meditators' first assumption is, oh, that's a distraction from my meditation. You know, if that dog wasn't barking, then, only then I'm sure I'd be fully enlightened. But there's no, you know, if only. It's like, if that's what's happening, if that's what's pronounced, is a dog barking, the sensations, the sense, the feeling, experience of listening becomes the focus of the meditative attention. And we just do listening meditation, hearing. We name it hearing in this case, hearing, that sensation. Being present for what that's like. Developing the ability to be in the present moment, encouraging yourself to stay in the present moment on just the act of hearing the dog bark. It's a little bit disappointing, maybe, because the breath, you know, has this great spiritual association. You know, feel like you're doing something spiritually important. The dog barking, I mean, what kind of spiritual importance is that? It's important because what we're doing is training our ability to be in the present moment for what is most pronounced in the present moment. To rest in our awareness and give our attention to what's really most pronounced in the present moment experience. And that ability, of course, translates to all kinds of benefits in the rest of our life. If you have the ability to give yourself to what's most pronounced, what needs attention, you know, you give yourself, you're able to develop focus at work and focus in your relationships and all kinds of situations. One of the great delights of this particular meditation practice is that there's no such thing as a distraction. There's just something else to pay attention to, and to discover the ability to have this luminous, independent freedom of presence in the midst of whatever life gives us, as opposed to demanding that life should be different so that we can be free. So that's a simple instruction on, hopefully, was simple enough on how to begin including your physical sensation as part of your meditation practice. Do you have any questions about that? Or anything I've said tonight? Yes, David.
Yes, you keep on saying pay attention to the breathing. I mean, that's a very big thing. It's like my belly is moving, my chest is moving, the muscles in my upper back are doing things.
The usual instruction is to give attention to that part of your breathing which is most pronounced.
Okay.
For some people it might be the belly rising and falling. For some people it's the chest. For some people it might be the air going in and out through the nostrils. Whatever aspect of the breathing process seems the most pronounced to your experience, let that be, we call it the anchor or the home for the attention. And so that's where we're cultivating our awareness in that place. So we get really familiar with one place. So you don't have to wonder, where should I be today? Or, you know, that's your anchor. That's the place you tend to go to. And also, it's very helpful if you know where that anchor is, that place, because if you go off and pay attention to something else for a while, like your sensations in your body, or if you get lost in your thoughts for a while, when you wake up and you're time to come back to your breathing, you used to automatically know where to go. It's like your default. Okay, my place is the belly rising and passing, so I just go there. I don't have to wonder, oh, where is the breath now? Is it all? Make sense? Yes?
What if that changes all the time? It seems like a form of monkey mind for me. That my breath is here, my breath is there. If I were to choose one spot, it'd be kind of arbitrary.
It's not a big deal. It doesn't have to be. There's no right or wrong. Just choose some place that's where it's most predominant generally, or where it's most comfortable or most appealing to be at, and just choose that. And then, and if you're watching your breath there, in this whatever place you choose, and then this, the predominant sensations of breath begin to move as you're watching it, maybe from the stomach up to the chest, you can just follow it then. But you have this one place which is a default. If you don't know what to do, just bring your attention to that one place. To keep it simple. So you don't have to be guessing or wondering or engineering. Or make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Yes?
I have a question about experience I earlier on this evening. I was sitting here listening to your talk and became aware of some real tension in my thighs and my arms and legs. And my impulse was to get up and go exercise. And I didn't do that. I sort of tried to feel it, but it didn't sort of go away. It was just sort of got worse. And then from another practice, I tried saying what I was feeling under my breath. Nobody can hear, I don't think.
So what was that?
I said it under my breath.
Yeah.
I have tension in my legs.
Yeah.
I have tension in my arms. And I said that, and it was sort of emotional. As opposed, I was aware of that but, and thinking it, but by saying it, then it sort of dissipated. And I'm wondering, is the meditative part just to be able to think it, or by, you said, in talk, permitting it, or identifying it? Is that, can that be a physical identification, like, say, attention, or you just sort of think that? Or that isn't the purpose at all, it's just to sort of tough it out until it goes away on its own.
This is a good question. The mindfulness, a very important element of mindfulness is a very simple, rudimentary recognition of what's happening in the present moment. So if you have tension in your legs, you need to recognize, oh, the tension is there. But it doesn't have to be verbalized, that kind of level of recognition, just recognizing, oh, there's tension there. A lot of people, it makes sense. I mean, it's not like an abnormal thing to want. A lot of people, when they feel some discomfort, we want to have some relief. We want to have a solution. We want to fix it. And that's a fine thing to do. And it has and in much of our life, that's kind of the way we operate. But in mindfulness practice itself, we're it's leading us to something much more transformative, much more powerful. And that is, rather than using a mindfulness practice, if we become aware of something which we think is a problem, rather than relating to it as a problem that needs to be fixed, we relate to it as a way to discover how to have an independent presence in the midst of it. Even if it gets stronger, we discover an ability to not be reactive in relationship to it, not be judgmental in relationship to it. We explore how we can strengthen, develop our ability to be present, to be mindful, to be aware, to have an awareness which is so much greater than our preoccupation with a particular problem. So that's very unsatisfying to people who really strongly have this momentum to always fix things and have relief. But in the long term, you'll discover a much deeper kind of release or even relief from that ability for the mind, for the awareness, for our presence, to be in an unreactive relationship to the world around us. Because a lot of the deep tensions in our life arise out of that reactivity. Now, as we bring our attention this way, oftentimes, we've been careful attention to tension or holding or pain in our body. Sometimes it will get stronger, but it's often the experience that sooner or later it tends to dissipate just from the act of attention itself. So you might get to relief just by doing the practice itself, but the point of the practice is not to get that kind of simple relief, but rather to go much more deeper into our psyche. Does that make sense? Yes?
Can mindfulness be ultimately be a kind of psychotherapy in the sense that earlier you spoke about how many of us are driven and are compulsive. Take, for example, compulsive eating, or compulsive sex, or compulsive work. How is it that becoming more in touch with your body and your, you know, your bodily experiences, how, you know, can that kind of disentangle one from kind of compulsive problems?
Very good. Yeah, very good. Many of the compulsive drives, like the ones you mentioned, come with ideas, come with thoughts, come with objects. And we tend to believe both the ideas that go with the compulsion, we tend to believe the compulsion. This compulsion kind of comes with, it's very convincing. It's like, this needs to be fulfilled, this needs to be done. And so we tend to act on it, kind of. It's very powerful to learn how to feel the impulse without acting on it.
So if that sort of thought, that compulsive thought, comes to mind during a sitting, what I'm getting is that you're just supposed to discard that and go back to the breath. What I would be more interested in is in somehow or other. You know, the goal, and there's probably, you know, I understand that there's not supposed to be any goal except to be in the moment, but, you know, the idea is to get rid of the, to become undriven rather than driven, to become
right.
Uncompulsive rather
right.
than compulsive. So how is that achieved? How is that, I'm just wondering what the dynamic is. You know, how, you know, someone who's compulsive, almost in a way, you know, can't help themselves.
The almost in a way, there is a little out. There's a little possibility, and that's what we work on in developing. And one of the powerful ways of dealing with compulsion is to have a very dedicated sitting practice where you're committed. In the sitting practice, you're not going to act on a compulsion. You're going to sit there, not move. And then you train yourself to just feel in your body what's going on in your body in connection to that compulsion. And we can learn how to ride out the desire. And it's very, quite interesting to ride a desire out. Desire will arise and get stronger and stronger, and then it'll peak and break, and then it'll just pass away. And if we learn, get some real confidence in our ability to ride out the desire, then they stop losing some of their compulsive nature. And a very powerful way to do that, to train oneself in doing that, is to do that in meditation, where we say, okay, at least here in my life, I'm not going to move. I'm not going to act on it.
Can you give me for example, let's say you're sitting and all of a sudden you want to go to the refrigerator and get a pizza.
Right.
you start getting into your bodily sensations and...
For right now, since today is mostly instructions, mostly I'm trying to expand the instruction into the body, it's very, very effective oftentimes to drop down into the felt sense in the body of what's happening. And if there's a strong desire for pizza in the refrigerator, there's a kind of a leaning forward, a kind of tightening of the stomach, a kind of upwelling energy in the body that kind of wants to go, a kind of restlessness in the legs. Let's go, you know. And all these sensations are coming, and so what we do is we just sit there and experience them and ride them out, and we learn to develop the discipline, the skill, the inner strength, the confidence that we can see it and recognize these things for what they are, and then ride them out and not be driven by them. They can still arise, but many times people are really compulsive. They don't even see it coming. They just kind of choo. But as the mindfulness gets stronger, you see it arise, and it might arise quite strongly, and you see you do have a choice. You have a choice between acting on it and not acting on it. And in not acting on it, let me feel it. It's very powerful to feel it. If you don't feel it, it might actually kind of begin operating in kind of subconsciously way, you know. But to drop down and feel it, and so you learn those things I talked about how to ride it out, and you get this confidence and strength, and in addition to that, as you can feel it, that compulsion in your body and your emotional life more and more fully, because you're really present for it and not giving into it, it just really shows itself. It gets really big, you know, it can be really powerful. You get to see it in a way you can't see it if you act on it. And if you really see it well and really experience it as a physical thing, you might see there's something under that's driving it. That our compulsive drivenness is being driven perhaps by fear. It's a secondary expression of something else. And if you can really use the mindfulness, really be still and really sit quietly and really look deeply and see the compulsiveness really for what it is, and then look through the cracks of it, you might see this sense of fear, insecurity, or the desire for love that's under it. And it becomes a whole different game then. And it's much more healing to go to the roots than it is to just deal with the surface of the compulsion. Good luck. It's great. Riding out desires like a rodeo sometimes. Yes?
Just curious, what is it that pays attention to the mind?
What's the mind? You tell me what the mind is first?
What is it that pays attention to thoughts?
Well, you know, it is an introductory course, and you know, you're not allowed to think yet, you guys. I mean, we cover thinking on the fourth class. I'm assuming none of you are thinking in your meditation until then. You haven't been told that it's okay. But the what is it? I don't know if you need to have a what. It's enough to know that there's awareness. There doesn't have to be a subject or an agent of the awareness. One of the traps that many of us fall into is we always expect there to be an agent who's in charge, and so we attribute things to an agent. And as the practice gets quite deep, you'll discover that there is no fundamental agent that's driving the show. It's a little bit scary sometimes to realize that, but that's later. You don't have to worry about that. So let's end with a brief sitting. Take one deep breath and relax into your body. Take another deep breath and see if you can just empty your mind the best you can. And then become aware of your body. Not so much as you're up in the head watching your body, but as if you're inside your body, you are your body. As if awareness occurs in the body. Feel and sense your body's experience of itself. In whatever way bodily sensations appear to you, let them just appear. whatever sense of physical presence is there for you, let it just be there. As if your body is a dear friend that you're receiving in your awareness. As if your body is just a dear friend that you allow itself to show itself to you. And then within this body, as part of this body, become aware of the inhalations and exhalations. Trust yourself to your breathing. Entrust yourself to your body. There's an ancient teaching in Buddhism that your best friend is your body. Are there ways or are there times in your daily life where you can have a greater respect and connectedness to your body? Where you can be more awake to your body's experience of being a living person? Thank you very much for this evening. And next week we'll talk about how to incorporate emotions as part of the mindfulness practice, something that interests a lot of people. And then, but it's a lot easier to understand how to incorporate emotions into the practice if you really begin understanding how to include the physical body as part of the practice. Now, the better you understand how to include your physical sensations as part of mindfulness, you'll find it easier it is to be mindful of emotions. So practice this next week in your daily sitting. As sensations in the body become more pronounced than your breath, bring your attention to those. When they pass away, come back to your breathing. Or if other ones arise and become even more pronounced, go to them. Whatever is most pronounced in the body, let that be your meditation. The mind wanders away, bring it back. In your daily life, you might see if there's more, look for opportunities in your daily life to be more connected to your body, how your body feels. And one of the very interesting places to do this, you might try this for next week. If you find yourself in situations where you feel like you're going to act compulsively, or you find a situation where you get angry and very reactive or very confused, or and maybe you get confused and you have a habitual unhealthy way of responding out of your confusion, and you feel like you have to do something or say something, try doing nothing. But don't be passive. Rather, do nothing. Give yourself a pause and give your attention to your body and feel what's going on in your body. Give yourself 10 seconds, a minute, some period of time to feel what's going on in your body. And then see if that changes the whole situation and gives you a better sense of maybe how to respond. Some of these compulsions that we want to act on, if we feel them carefully, have very short lifetimes. And the last thing to say is that for those of you who might be new tonight, we have two baskets out in the hallway for if you want to make a donation for the class. And one basket is to help pay for our expenses for putting on the class and renting the room and such things. And we suggest that everyone put in $2 in the, what's called the expense basket. And the other is the teacher basket. And the suggestion is that it's a $10 donation for each class for that. But it's a donation system, which means that you do whatever you wish. And we really want it to be available to people of any kind of means, so they can come freely, and the money is not an issue, if it is an issue. So thank you very much, and I'll see you next week.